Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cagliano. How are you doing, Frank?
David, I'm great. I'm back, baby.
Yeah, listeners may have, attentive listeners may notice we haven't had an episode in a couple of weeks because Frank was on vacation in Sweden. So we decided to have him, allow him to have that vacation uninterrupted by the demands of podcasting. So welcome back from Sweden, Frank.
Thank you very much.
And listeners, we want to apologize. We know we've been having audio issues in some of our recent episodes, and we are working very hard to try to get as good an audio quality as we can. But neither of us are audiophiles or audio technicians, so you're stuck with amateurs doing this. So apologies, but we're working on it.
Yeah, if I can say something about that, David, I think it should be acknowledged that you're very kind to include me in that statement. You do all the work on the tech side, and you deserve all the credit. And I'm not saying this by way of blame in any way. Yes. You deserve the credit for it because this is your responsibility mainly. So I'm grateful to you for doing that.
Thank you.
Although, listeners, if you do want to blame somebody,
blame me. That's fine. I'm willing to accept all the blame for the yes. The quality of the content, though, I think you share equal responsibility, Frank.
Yes, that's right. But, I do.
All right. So, switching to a somewhat somber topic. Earlier this week, on September 19th, we lost Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg after a very long tenure on the Supreme Court, who passed away at the age of 87. And so we thought we would use this episode to talk about Justice Ginsburg, her career, both before her time on the Supreme Court and during her time on the Supreme Court, and to talk about what her death means for this particular moment. As President Trump has announced, he is going to nominate a replacement for Justice Ginsburg potentially today, potentially tomorrow, depending on people are listening to this. So there will be a fight over that nomination, which looks like it may be one of the most contentious fights ever in the history of Supreme Court nominations. Right. So, Frank, what can we say that hasn't already been said in the past few days about Ruth Bader Ginsburg? She's been, the remembrances of her have been really quite profound over the past few days.
Yeah, in truth, David, the way you frame the question, I think our answer would be nothing. The remembrances and the tributes have been thorough, fulsome, and well-deserved. And there's very little we can add, I think, but that doesn't make for a very good podcast, I think.
There are a few things, though, that I think are really, noteworthy about her, obviously her the discrimination she personally faced, I think, as many people have highlighted, is worth, sort of remembering that she was somebody who faced an enormous amount of discrimination as a consequence of her gender, really from the time that, throughout her career. She graduated the top of her class at Columbia and basically couldn't find a job despite being one of the top lawyers in the country. She applied to work as a Supreme Court clerk then and was refused because she was a woman. She actually started law school at Harvard and she was, I think, one of nine women in out of a class of 500 at Harvard Law School. And the Harvard dean said the first week she was there, the dean invited all the women, all nine of them, over for dinner. And he asked them pointedly, "Why are you taking the place of a man at Harvard Law School?" I think she, faced tremendous amounts of discrimination, after law school, finding employment. Actually one of the places, thinking, connecting to your recent trip to Sweden, one of the places where she went because she couldn't find employment in the U.S., she spent, I think, 2 years in Sweden.
And learned Swedish.
And learned Swedish. And part of that, I guess my understanding, and you probably know more about this than I do, Frank, that the Swedes had more opportunities for women lawyers, in the 60s and 70s than were available in the United States.
Well, and she was there in the early 60s at a particular moment when I think Sweden was, and to some extent remains, at the cutting edge of feminism globally. And so I think that was an important moment for her based on the reading I've done for this episode, in terms of helping crystallize her thinking about what society could look like if it were committed to more equitable gender relations. So her time in Sweden is generally reckoned to be quite important in her long life. And the book she wrote about, I think, Swedish or feminism and the law in Sweden is still highly regarded, at least as one of the works in English on that topic. So, sorry, I want to be clear that in response to your question of what do we have to add, it's not that there isn't anything to say about Justice Ginsburg. My comment was, you and I have little to add apart from the sum up what so many others have said so well. But you're absolutely right. I mean, her career, her life, it's a very interesting life story. And I would commend, if people are looking for, a fairly lengthy piece, but well worth your time, is the New York Times obituary on her, which is very thorough. And she was the daughter of Russian Jewish immigrants. She was a first generation American. She faced, as you say, considerable discrimination, as a young woman and after achieving her education as a lawyer, argued 6 cases before the Supreme Court, I believe, prior to being named onto the court, and won 5 of them, most relating to issues relating to women's rights and or gender equality. She was particularly active in the ACLU in the 60s and 70s after her return from Sweden with regard to issues associated with voting rights. And that's with an area which she's most was best known for, I suspect, in terms of being nominated to the court. She was nominated, named to the Supreme Court by Bill Clinton in 93.
And was really, I think, one of the things that's really remarkable about her time as a advocate before the Supreme Court as a lawyer, especially in these gender discrimination cases, was very often she was arguing for discrimination against men, right? I think that was the sort of the clever trick that she used. It was oftentimes pointing out those places where the law discriminated against men and therefore was able to install in the jurisprudence of the 14th Amendment that the all persons part of the 14th Amendment applies to women as well. So there was a case, for instance, where a man was denied survivor benefits from Social Security that would have gone to a widow, but doesn't go to a widower because of the sort of gendered way in which the legislation was written. There was likewise a case that involved compulsory jury service for men, but optional jury service for women. And she argued that was discriminatory and that women should have compulsory jury service as well. And so it was an interesting way of sort of using the sort of obviously very gendered and sexism of the court sort of against itself to help create this sort of new standards for 14th Amendment's jurisprudence.
That's right.
And when she's on the court itself, she was nominated as a moderate, but really became over the course of her career seen as one of the most liberal justices, and wrote a number of important dissents, especially recently, being very critical of some of the directions the court has taken in recent years.
Yeah, although it should be said, David, that's correct, but it also reflects the rightward shift of the court.
Court,
so to some extent,
yes.
It's not that she necessarily moved to the left as the court moved to the right, and suddenly her moderation appeared to be quite left-wing.
Yeah, oh, to be sure. Although I think she was progressively more willing to sort of show... to articulate some of her more leftist views as things became, at least from her perspective, more intolerable in terms of
That's
some
right.
of the decisions in the court.
I
heard this interesting story just actually a few weeks before she died that they had audio recordings of her when she was a lawyer before the Supreme Court and audio recordings of her when she was a justice on the Supreme Court. And one of the things that's clear from those two is that her Brooklyn accent becomes much more pronounced when she's a justice than when she was a lawyer.
Well, we've all, you know, we know about code shifting and things like that,
exactly,
don't we?
Exactly.
Life
exactly.
tenure on the court means you can revert to your national accent. When I am named to the Supreme Court, I can fully embrace my Boston accent again. Which
that
I've
I want to hear.
Suppressing.
That's what you've been doing, Frank? Okay, good. Okay. Secret plan to get on the court.
excuse me, David. One thing that I think is interesting is Justice Ginsburg was the second woman named to the court. The first was Sandra Day O'Connor, and Sandra Day O'Connor was named by President Reagan. She was seen as quite conservative, at least early on, despite her role as a pioneer. Her background couldn't have been much more different from Justice Ginsburg. Sandra Day O'Connor was sort of from the Southwest. She was from Arizona. Her parents were ranchers. Unlike the small shop owners in Brooklyn that Ruth Bader Ginsburg's parents were. But they formed a quite close relationship, in part because they were the only two women on the court. What surprised me in reading about this is Sandra Day O'Connor was only 3 years older than Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So they were much closer in age than I realized, because Sandra Day O'Connor was on the court, obviously, much earlier than Ginsburg. And I always assumed she was much older, but she was only a few years older. And that they struck up an interesting friendship. And this is one of the things that's important to remember about the court, because outsiders, which is almost everybody on earth, apart from the members of the justices themselves, do scorekeeping and, you know, put them in categories. And this is a human institution like any other, and people strike up friendships and antipathies like any other workplace. And often these straddle ideological and political divides.
Famously, she used to go to the opera with Antonin Scalia.
That's right.
Which seems bizarre when you know about the jurisprudence, but friendships work in weird ways.
That's right. That's right.
And I guess mutual love of opera or something. I actually got to meet her once briefly.
Did you?
Yeah.
So tell us that story.
I met her at a reception at the Supreme Court. My father's was doing stuff with the American Bar Association and had things in D.C. and they had a reception in the Supreme Court, and I got to be the plus one for that, and got to meet her for 15 seconds and shake her hand. She was dressed and behaved exactly like you'd expect her to. She was wearing the lace necklace or lace collar and gloves. And she is as petite as everyone says she was.
Right. And maybe, at the end of her life, that's interesting. You had that experience, but it's also, she did become iconic in her 80s in a way that is fairly unusual. So she became a kind of cultural phenomenon in a way that I can't think of another Supreme Court justice, certainly, who's, and became notorious RBG and her image, kids dressed as her, little girls in particular, on Halloween and things like this, and
the Saturday Night Live bits and all these kinds of things. Yeah, you don't have any other Supreme Court justices, at least that I can think of, that have that kind of cultural relevance. You can't see sort of Justice Frankfurter or something, or Brandeis, being caricatured in quite the same way.
Yeah, although caricature is an interesting word, because it was all done lovingly. Most of the people who were embracing this image were doing so out of real affection. And in fact, the genuine grief expressed in the last week has been, again, quite unusual for a Supreme Court justice, because basically these people operate behind the scenes. They operate not quite in secret, but not far from it. And they're just generally not that well known, but she kind of broke through into the broader culture very late in life, very late.
Yeah, no, I think the court has tried very hard to avoid making justices into celebrities at various points in time. The justices have talked about how important it is that they go to the grocery store and not be recognized. And they've used that as justification for not having cameras in the courtroom and sort of remain relatively anonymous, even if they are enormously powerful and famous. They like to sort of maintain that relative anonymity. And she's probably the first celebrity Supreme Court justice, if that's the right terminology to think about it.
Yeah, I think certainly the only one I can think of.
I mean, there are obviously there are tons of famous Supreme Court and well-known Supreme Court justices and well-loved, you know, Supreme Court justices, but not ones that had that kind of that developed that kind of patina of celebrity that she did. And my understanding is she was all rather amused by the whole thing because, you know, the notorious RBG memorabilia or you know, tote bags and what have you. I think she found that quite funny.
It was quite moving, the image earlier this week when she was lying in state at the court to see all of her clerks on the steps, you know, and of course they were socially distant, which made the image more powerful, but that was a very, very powerful image. Now, all of these justices over the course of their career have many clerks, most of whom I think are quite dedicated to them. I think if you work that closely with a justice, you become dedicated to them. So it's not that she was necessarily unique in that, but that was a very, very powerful image. And the kind of devotion that her clerks showed to her, I think, was quite telling. And, you know, we read a lot about this week. Did you see the anecdote about her fantasy baseball team?
No. Who did she have on her fantasy baseball
team? I don't know who she had on her fantasy baseball team. One of her clerks had the various clerks had a fantasy baseball league a few years ago in the Supreme Court. They probably still do. And Ginsburg's chief clerk, I'm not using the right language here. One of her clerks was running the fantasy baseball team for her, representing her part of the court. And he went to her to say, "Hey, we're winning." And she had to say, "Well, what is fantasy baseball?" I had this explained to her. And basically, I'm going to get this anecdote wrong, so I apologize to listeners. Google it and get the right details. It was either Scalia or Alito, but the guy said, "Well, we're beating him. That's all that matters." And she said, "Great." And apparently there was some snarky email between Ginsburg, a good-natured snark between Ginsburg and let's say Scalia over their fantasy baseball teams, or the fantasy baseball teams that were being created in their names on the Supreme Court. So this goes to the kind of dedication and devotion of her clerks and the interest she seemed, again, according to all the reports, taken in them and in their lives and so on. So anyway, I've mangled that anecdote very badly, which is why it's a podcast. So just Google it yourselves, but it's a very interesting story. But I think she wasn't just an icon. I mean, her most important decision that she was involved in as a majority decision was in the United States versus Virginia in 1996. And that case turned on changing the Virginia Military Institute, the history of which you'll know quite well, from a all-male college to coeducational. And at issue was the fact that the state of Virginia created a separate women's military academy. We know the history of separate but equal in the United States, and it's not a good one. And the court ruled, I believe it was 7-1 in that decision in 1996. And in that case, Justice Ginsburg wrote the majority opinion, striking down that law and stipulating that VMI had to be coeducational because a separate military academy for women was not appropriate and was not equal. And to many respects, that's her land, you know, moving beyond the notorious RBG and the cultural icon. And that's important. There's a really important kind of legacy of judicial legacy there as well.
And I think that the legacy of her dissents are also really, really important. I mean, she was known for also for writing some very passionate dissents, some of which actually had some real significant consequences. Probably the most important of those is Ledbetter versus Goodyear. This was a case involving gender pay discrimination where the court ruled 5-4 that even though a woman was discriminated based on gender, that the statute of limitations had run out because she didn't know that she was being discriminated based on gender until well after she was. And Ginsburg wrote this dissent saying, "That's stupid. You can't file suit being discriminated against if you don't know you're being discriminated against, even if you are in powerful ways," and encouraged Congress to pass a law to remedy this, and Congress did. And so I think, you know, she's a really sort of powerful spokesperson, even in dissent.
Well, and dissents are important, as you know, David, because nothing is forever. And the court is about precedent, but it's also, you know, when the court wants to change a view over time, you know, future courts often look to dissenting opinions for precedent as well. And so establishing a body of well-written dissents is actually quite an important legacy, although it's a kind of potential legacy, I suppose. But you're right. Her reputation as a writer of powerful dissents was, especially later in her career, was important.
Right. So the President Trump has announced that he is intending to nominate a replacement for Justice Ginsburg any time now. And Senator Mitch McConnell has said that he intends to have the Senate vote to approve this nominee as soon as possible. How are we supposed
Wait, David, that's not true.
Isn't that?
No, Mitch McConnell told us back in 2016 that he can't appoint a Supreme Court justice in an election year.
Oh, but that was in a very specific case, Frank, you see. And now he says this is a slightly different case. So what Frank is referring to there is when Justice Scalia died 9 months prior to the 2016 election, Mitch McConnell said that the Senate has a habit of not confirming Supreme Court justices during an election year, which people pointed out actually isn't a precedent at all. But Mitch McConnell said that was what they were going to do. And so when President Obama nominated Merrick Garland to fill Scalia's seat, Mitch McConnell said, that's nice, but we're not going to consider that nomination at all. There were no hearings. There was none of the sort of usual procedure. And so the seat sat empty for 9 months until President Trump was elected and then filled by Neil Gorsuch subsequent to Trump's inauguration. So McConnell had this rule, and McConnell seems to suggest the rule doesn't apply anymore. And he has some very convoluted logic about why the rule applied in 2016 and doesn't apply now when we are even closer to the election.
39 days away today.
39 days away. Okay, that's not much time at all.
Well, in fact, sorry, apropos of time, David, I'm sorry to interrupt you. The average Supreme Court, the average time it takes to confirm a Supreme Court nominee, at least in the recent past, has been 70 days. So just to give people some perspective on, you know, why 39 days matters. And so if President Trump, and there was talk that he's either going to name his nominee today or tomorrow. So if it's tomorrow, Saturday, it'll be 38 days. Under normal circumstances, it takes 70 days to confirm a justice or reject a justice. So that's the kind of time frame we're talking about. And of course, we're in the midst of a pandemic as well and a presidential election. So these are not normal times.
So, you know, it is not normal times. And that's 100%. So let me just sort of talk about what happens usually during that 70 days. Why does it take usually that long to nominate, or between the nomination and the confirmation of a justice? What happens during those 70 days?
Well, one reason it takes so long is senators don't work very hard, apparently. I mean, they're only in session, what, 3 or 4 days a week? Senate Judiciary Committee usually holds hearings and makes a recommendation and endorses or fails to endorse a candidate. And then then the nominee will go to a vote of the full Senate. And they in most cases, are confirmed, but not in all cases. And
usually lasts four or five days, something like that, of hearings, at least in the recent past.
That's right. And so what we're, well.
And the other thing, there's a few other things I think that are happening.
Yeah, please.
So, you know, there's been a custom recently of the nominee meeting with every individual senator, which involves a lot of sort of, I guess, sort of hand-holding, taking the nominee from senator to senator to have, you know, sit down half hour meetings to discuss whatever it is the senator wants to talk about. And for at least most of the 20th century, or the second half at least of the 20th century, there was usually a independent assessment of the candidate, usually by the American Bar Association, where they have a committee of people who look into the career of the nominee, look at their you know, their education, their previous judicial record, their record as a lawyer. They interview, you know, former clerks they may have had or former business associates, and they come up with a rating of qualified or unqualified or highly qualified. That seems to have fallen in the wayside with the Trump administration. So there was a lot of stuff that went into the, at least the second half of the 20th century when people got nominated to the Supreme Court. It is worth pointing out, though, that if you go back earlier in the court's history, there are lots of nominees that get approved much faster. We Yep. have dozens of nominees in the 19th century that are not, that are confirmed the day after they're nominated. And at least one case that I could find where a person is confirmed the day he is nominated.
Who was that? Do you, can you remember?
Salmon Chase.
Right. Okay. Salmon P. Chase.
Chase. Yes. Yes. And, well, that's an interesting situation because that actually involves an election. We can maybe talk about that in a minute. But, you know, the one of the things about the Senate is the Senate is very much just run by custom. And a lot of these sort of things are as much of customary as they are regulated by law. And so, you know, this custom of visiting every senator, they don't have to do that.
And we've seen that they're willing, certainly the Trump administration and its allies in the House and Senate are willing to break norms.
Right. So, on the one hand, it does seem to be a breaking of tradition to try to sort of fast track this. On the other hand, it does seem like Mitch McConnell has the power constitutionally to fast track this. And, Trump could nominate somebody tomorrow and they could have a confirmation hearing on Monday, at least in theory.
Yes, in theory. Yeah. I mean, there are some really interesting questions which we might get into as to what the right thing, sorry, by right, I'm not talking about ethically, I'm talking about politically, the right approach would be for both the Democrats and the Republicans given these circumstances, I think. For example, Mitch McConnell, Democrats can point out the hypocrisy of Mitch McConnell's position.
And I don't think he cares.
And certainly do so. I know he doesn't care. And people like Lindsey Graham, who are on record as saying, you know, in 2016, this is, you know, we shouldn't do this. And now they've done a 180 on it. It's worth pointing that out. I don't think that's a hill to die on because they don't care. This is about power. And in part, I think that's because they can read the polls just like everybody else. And I think there's a distinct possibility, the Economist has it at a 67%. The Nate Silver has it a bit lower than that, 58-59%, that the Democrats will win the Senate in November. And if that's the case, this opportunity, which is the opportunity of a generation, will pass. And and the Democrats will name the next or have a say in who the next justice will be. And this is something that Republicans, especially grassroots Republicans, have been working for generations to really solidify their hold on the court, and it's within grasp. And they're not going to let it pass just because people will rightly call them hypocrites for their position 4 years ago.
Yeah, I think it is about power politics much more.
That's right. But whether it's good politics is an interesting question. Because, Act Blue, I believe the figure is they raised $200 million in the past week since Justice Ginsburg died for Democratic Senate candidates in response to this power grab by the Republicans. So they may win this seat, but it may come at a cost. I don't think it's entirely clear how this works, how the politics of this play out. For example, I've heard some people say, oh, this is really good because it energizes Trump's base. That may be so, but it'll also energize the opposition to Trump if they're seen to rush this through. So yeah. I don't know what you think about all
that. Well, I think predicting the impact on the electorate for this particular election is so difficult. Given the pandemic, given all the other things that are going on. And given sort of how unreliable the polls were 4 years ago, I think, trying to do anything other than power politics makes very little sense at this point for either party. trying to do the you know, lose one for the team, and then hopefully that will sort of position them better for the next whatever stage it is. You know, I don't think that makes a whole lot of sense at this point. Is there anything that Democrats can do to in the Senate to stop Mitch McConnell at all if they want to confirm a Trump nominee between now and the election?
Ooh, between now and the election, that's a slightly, I probably no. I mean, the best they can do is stall,
yeah,
right? And they can draw things out. So maybe they, for the reasons I just said, it's, you know, 39 days till the election. That's not very much. They might be able to draw things out, and that may well suit the Republicans anyway. As I said, in terms of trying to gin up the electorate. And frankly, I think it suits President Trump. Any day we're not talking about COVID is a good day for him because, you know, the polls have basically been set in stone for a while now. Some movement, but not a huge amount of movement. And every day that the focus is on the epidemic is a bad day for President Trump, it seems to me, electorally. So when the focus turns, if we spend the next 39 days arguing about the Supreme Court, I don't think that necessarily hurts him. Now, that's not the answer to your question. I think the Democrats could stall and try to draw things out, but I don't think they can stop it.
Right. The filibuster for Supreme Court nominees is gone, so they can't do that. There's procedural things they can do to slow things down a little bit, but just given the way that the rules of the Senate work at the moment, I'm not sure any of that's going to 39 days.
There will be hearings, but certainly the people who are being seen, the women, because Trump is committed to nominating a woman whose names are being mentioned, have records that the Democrats will examine, and rightly so. But I don't think there'll be controversial hearings in the way that the Kavanaugh hearings were a couple of years ago. And so I don't think it'll be drawn out because of that. I, in answer to your question, I don't think there's any way to stop the Republicans that the Democrats can use to stop the Republicans putting somebody in this seat. I'm a little uncertain. I'm slightly hesitant about the timing. I just don't know whether they might be able to delay it till after the election. But as I said, I'm not even sure whether that works to their advantage either. This is a really important seat, of course, because, Supreme Court seats are always important. But if it's a 6-3 conservative majority on the court, really, the questions coming up will be about the Affordable Care Act, about reproductive rights. But there also may be questions about, you know, if President Trump is reelected, then there may be, you know, his legal problems will continue and there'll be issues about gaining access to records, and we'll have 4 more years of that, and the court will play a role in those. If the election doesn't go his way and it's contested and we have a kind of Florida situation like we had in Florida in 2000, but in multiple states, the Supreme Court might be called in to adjudicate that, and therefore a 6-3 majority would be very...
And Trump has said this. I mean, he says he expects the court to have some voice in the election, which is a bizarre thing to say before an election.
Well, the fact that he's not willing to... He's not willing to acknowledge that he will accept the outcome is interesting.
Yes,
look, I think their internal polling must be very bad at the moment.
Yes. But, you know, and he's repeatedly, said that the election will be, if he loses, he said it's going to be because of voter fraud or something.
Right. So the court could be involved in all of that, which is why they want to fill this seat as well.
You know, I mean, one thing I've been thinking about is this is, you know, one of the things that makes this different from the Neil Gorsuch taking over for Scalia in some ways is this is going to be a liberal justice being replaced by presumably a very conservative justice. You know, in terms of actually having a real shift in the court. And it made me sort of think about those other times when we've had justices replaced by somebody who is very different than they are. You know, and the ones that come to mind, Thurgood Marshall being replaced by Clarence Thomas in 1991.
Right, yep.
Where Thurgood Marshall was one of the more liberal members of the court, and Clarence Thomas has proved to be one of the most conservative members of the court. Makes me think of Earl Warren being replaced by Warren Burger as Chief Justice in 1969. Again, a very sort of liberal justice being replaced by a somewhat more conservative justice, and you can see the whole court shifting that way. But the one that really sort of jumps out to me as being the most relevant is when Roger Taney dies in October of 1864. So this is right. Taney, of course, was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the author of the Dred Scott decision, a slaveholder from Maryland, a white supremacist through and through.
Canada for one of the worst justices ever.
Yes.
Yes. Carry on.
And part of the reason, people's thoughts about him have changed radically over time, as witnessed by the removal of some of his statues recently. But he dies in October of 1864, 27 days before the election. So this actually, in terms of the relative scheduling, actually sort of fits. And he gets replaced by Salmon Chase in just immediately after the election, but during the window between the election and the inauguration of both a new Congress and Lincoln's second inaugural.
Crucially a new president. It's the same president.
It's the same president. And that's actually the same window in which Lincoln pushes through the 13th Amendment. So if you remember the Lincoln movie, for those people who are cineophiles, that's that same moment. But what's, thinking about those two people as one replacing the other, here we have Taney, who said that, African Americans could not be citizens of the United States, were never conceived of as citizens, and Chase, who admits the first African American to the Supreme Court bar. One of the first things he does as Chief Justice, when he allows John Rock to join the court bar in 1864. And so, this is going to be likewise a fairly sizable shift in jurisprudence from in this case, from the left end of the spectrum for the court to presumably going to be one of the more conservative justices on an already very conservative court.
Yes. I would say two things in response to that. One is interesting factoid that of the six, assuming this seat is filled by President Trump, which I think is highly likely, the six conservative justices, who will comprise that conservative bloc would have all been nominated by presidents who did not win the popular vote. So these will be minority presidents. These will be justices nominated by George W. Bush and Donald Trump, those six justices, and confirmed by the Senate, which of course is dominated and gives predominance to or undue weight to rural states. And so these are very much minority justices. They don't necessarily represent the majority view of the country. And so it will have an interesting situation where
democracy, this is a problematic.
It's not just that. I mean, also in terms of the degree to which the court reflects the country, I'm not talking demographically, I'm talking ideologically, there's an open question about that. And that, I mean, that does bother John Roberts, I think, which is interesting as the Chief Justice to some extent. Two-thirds of the public in polling, it shows that two-thirds of the public think that we should wait until after the election to fill this seat, and they're going to ram it through. So that's interesting, especially. So there's that element to it. The other thing is the 6-3 majority. Supreme Court justices have life tenure. We know that. They don't live forever. So it's not going to be 6-3 forever. This is a pandemic going on. These are people who are not young. It looks bleak now, depending on your judicial and political, one's judicial or political sympathies. But stuff happens. People retire. People die. Who knows how long it will last? It could last a very long time, but it may not last as long as many people fear.
Yeah. I mean, the Roberts has sort of been the swing justice, ironically, for the past couple of years.
Yeah.
But I don't think he will anymore. I mean, for instance, he was the swing justice in preserving the Affordable Care Act. And I don't think that's necessarily going to be in play anymore, even if Roberts votes to preserve the Affordable Care Act. And there's a case that the court's going to hear very, very soon, I think just next month, about the Affordable Care Act. And he is, you know, even if he votes to preserve it, it could be ruled unconstitutional. So there's going to be huge consequences for this seat about healthcare, reproductive rights, about the regulatory state, about the environment, about all kinds of things.
Voting rights. Yep. No. This is, sorry, I'm not trying to downplay the significance of the appointment, but it's very, very significant. There's no doubt about that.
And so, you know, we've been hearing in this past week some really interesting, since the power politics seems to be the moment, the move of the day, you know, what responses maybe Democrats could have after the election were Trump to get his nominee approved, including adding more justices to the court. I've heard that from multiple people. Yep. I've heard suggestions of maybe having term limits or some kind of adding some kind of way of having some rotation on the court to shift the ideological balance. What do you think about all that?
Well, I have to confess, I'm not a legal scholar, so I'm out of my depth slightly here. Look, 9 is not a sacred number. The court has varied in size over the years. There is a strong case to be made for the very democratic reasons we were alluding to earlier in terms of how justices have been appointed, particularly the justices on this court, to try and seek a sort of democratic with a small d redress of that imbalance. And, you know, the Neil Gorsuch's seat was stolen effectively by Mitch McConnell 4 years ago. And, you know, Merrick Garland's seat, which is now occupied by Neil Gorsuch. It's not too much to say that they stole that seat. And arguably, given that they're going to violate the precedent they set then with whoever they appoint now, that's 2 seats. So I could see expanding the court to 11. I've heard people say, oh, but if you do that, where does it end? Because, of course, you won't be in power forever. Fine, let's have 501 justices eventually and have it sponsored by Levi's. I'm going to do that.
Get rid of the robes, go right to blue jeans. Okay, good.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so fine. I hear that argument, but I think, look, we've seen a lot of norms violated and overturned in recent years. And I think we have to, one of the only sanctions the Democrats have actually is the threat of impending vengeance. Yeah. And it seems to me that if I were a Democrat in the Senate, I would, you know, I think repealing the filibuster overall, not just for the judicial nominees, and expanding the Supreme Court are both things that should be in play. There's further talk about statehood for places like Puerto Rico, if Puerto Rico wants it, and D.C. and other places. Again, I think anything that makes the country more democratic, because we are governed by a system that was created in the 18th century that was inherently undemocratic. So,
to preserve the rights of slaveholders and
white men. Well, not only, but that was an element. That was a key element of it. So any attempts that can be made or any changes that can be made to make the system more democratic with a small d, are to be welcomed in my view. And I think we're heading towards a political and constitutional kind of crisis or moment of change, because there's a lot of pent-up frustration in the system, given that the views of tens of millions of people are effectively being disregarded at the moment.
I 100% agree. You know, so the number of justices, of course, is not mentioned in the Constitution. That's a matter of statute. There have been, at the first court, there were 6. There have been as few as 5. There's been as many as 10 justices on the court. So the 9 has been, you know, the custom for 150 years or so, but it's not magic in any ways. And I think they came up with 9. My understanding was because that was the number of circuit courts there were, and they wanted to have one justice for each circuit. We now have 13 circuits. Why not have 13?
Yeah.
Why not? Yeah. Of course the president everyone points to is Roosevelt's court packing plan, which at least politically didn't work. Although in some ways the court shifted immediately thereafter. So it's sort of hard to sort of read the tea leaves on that. But I guess the big difference between now and the 1930s is the 1930s people looked at the court and believed it was apolitical in some ways, even though it was very political. And now I don't think anybody thinks the court is apolitical. And so that sort of mythology of the apolitical court has gone to the wayside. So yeah, why not put 13 people on the court, 15 people on the court? Because that seems to be the kinds of politics that we're headed towards. Right. It's going to be how many days did you say we have? 39 days?
39, David.
These are going to be historic.
It's going to be the longest decade of our life. These 39 days.
Oh, jeez. Right.
And that doesn't even get to the, we'll talk about this in coming weeks, of course, but what the post-election period is going to look like, which I really do think could be unprecedented and crazy.
Yes. I miss the boringness of the 1990s where the squabbles were over for stupid things.
Yes, it's 9:05. The polls have closed. We'd like to declare so and so the president. Exactly. Everybody, yeah. Go to bed. Those are the days.
Oh yeah, boy. Oh well. Right, it's time for last drops, Frank. What did you got?
I want to mark, David, I think it was September 19th. Recently was the 100th birthday, I should say, of Roger Angel, who's a great writer for The New Yorker. He first joined the staff of The New Yorker in 1944. He was the fiction editor for a long time, but he's best known to many people for his essays in the magazine, especially his essays on baseball. He's still alive. He's still writing. This is a man whose kind of lifetime as a baseball fan, he saw Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig play.
That's remarkable.
And he blogged the 2017 World Series. So just what he has seen is remarkable, but it's not even for that. He is a brilliant, brilliant prose stylist and essayist. And so whether you're a baseball fan or not, I commend almost anything he's written to you because he writes so beautifully and writes with a kind of gentleness and sensitivity. It's not about fandom per se, although I'm going to read a passage to you in a second about what it is to be a fan. But he always wrote about from the perspective of the fan.
Mm.
Without being patronizing either to fans or to players. He wrote about what he saw. So he's covered World Series by watching all the games in a bar or that, yeah. but also just writes so beautifully. And, and in writing for The New Yorker, there's a very high standard of writing for The New Yorker. It's a very difficult one to meet, yet writes in an unpretentious fashion. So yeah, one of his
writes in a way that you can like, if you haven't been following the box scores, you can still follow the article, right? It's meant
that's for... right. That's right. And so in fact, one thing I want to commend to you is a recent podcast marking Angel's 100th birthday on, there's a podcast called Effectively Wild, which is a baseball podcast, which I strongly recommend to anybody who's interested in baseball. And the contributors there, reflected on Angel's life, but then they had a series of, almost 20 people who pre-recorded, journalists and various figures from around the baseball world reflecting on Angel. It's beautiful to listen to. So I can recommend that episode. And Meg Rowley on Effectively Wild is really, really great. So let me just read one passage, if that's all right, if you'll indulge.
Oh, sure. Yo, by all means.
This is from one of Angel's most famous essays, which was called Agincourt and After, which again makes him sound pretentious, but he's not. And he wrote that this appeared in November of 1975 after the famous 1975 World Series. And he writes the following, and I think this is a kind of typical passage from Angel, but also one of his most famous. And he's writing about fandom. It is foolish and childish, on the face of it, to affiliate ourselves with anything so insignificant and patently contrived and commercially exploitive as a professional sports team. And the amused superiority and icy scorn that the non-fan directs at the sports nut, I know this look, I know it by heart, is understandable and almost unanswerable. Almost. What is left out of this calculation, it seems to me, is the business of caring. Caring deeply and passionately, really caring. What is a capacity or an emotion that is almost, really caring, which is a capacity or emotion that is almost gone out of our lives. And so it seems possible that we have come to a time when it no longer matters so much what the caring is about. How frail or foolish is the object of that concern, as long as the feeling itself can be saved. Naivety, the infantile and ignoble joy that sends a grown man or woman to dancing and shouting with joy in the middle of the night over the haphazardous flight of a distant ball seems a small price to pay for such a gift. That's writing.
Yeah.
Happy birthday, Roger Angel.
Wow.
Sorry, I missed. I stumbled a bit in the middle of that, which ruined the moment. But yeah, very, very. And one can only imagine. So the amused superiority and icy scorn that the non-fan directs at the sports nut. The guy worked in the New Yorker.
Yes, I can imagine that.
You can imagine the amount of scorn the sports fan receives in the New Yorker.
Yes.
And so anyway, if you can read, get something by Roger Angel, any of his books, which are basically collections of his New Yorker essays. Yeah.
Boys of Summer, I guess.
That's Roger.
You're right. Thanks.
But any of his books, which are collections of his New Yorker pieces, if you're just interested in good prose and beautiful writing and really good essay writing, I can recommend him to you. So happy birthday, Roger Angel.
Oh.
David, what's your last drop?
Well, I want to endorse a new segment on BBC Scotland, one that had its premiere this morning, and that is on their morning show, Good Morning Scotland, where they have a new feature, I guess, every Friday with one professor, Frank Cogliano of the University of Edinburgh, who is commenting on American politics and elections. So Frank, for people who don't get enough of him on the podcast, you can now listen to him on BBC Scotland every Friday morning, and they've got it on it's online too. So if you're not listening on your radio here in Scotland, you can listen to it later at your leisure. So Frank,
ahead, David. Thank you.
How'd you get involved in all that?
Well, the host of that segment, Laura McKeever, is actually a former student. She was an American Studies student at the University of Edinburgh. I met Laura, and she was a very good student when I first arrived. And she is one of the hosts on Friday morning of Good Morning Scotland. And she pitched this to me a couple of months ago. She said, "Hey, Neil, maybe we could do a segment on in the run up to the election on Friday mornings." And so that's how this. I'm grateful to Laura for that opportunity, and always enjoy trying to speak to the public. So that's how it came up. So
great. So people can get an extra half hour, Frank, every day, every week.
At least. It's only 7 minutes.
But the richness of the content, Frank, made it seem
endless.
Exactly. But yeah, so if you listen to it online, you got to sort of scroll through some other stuff about Scotland and the pandemic and universities and other things. So it's like the last sort of 7 or 8 minutes of the show.
Yeah. So if you go to today, thank you for mentioning it, David. If you go to today's episode, I think I ended up going on about 8:50 or 8:52 or something like that, right before the end of the episode.
So great. All right. Until next week, Frank. Cheers.
Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.